Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
In the 1960s, Dolores DeLuce was rejected by her family for giving birth to a biracial child, only to be embraced by a different kind of family. Her new family included Divine, the Cockettes, assorted Venice Beach bad boys, and her many loving gay husbands. Along the way, she met many freaky celebrities like John Waters, Edith Massey, Rip Taylor, and Joan Rivers, and was even crowned Miss Alternative L.A.
Our guest today, Dolores DeLuce, was one of the few women to perform with the Cockettes, the highly influential theater group of hippie drag queens in San Francisco of the early 70s. A 5-foot diva in 6-inch heels, Dolores slept with many a gay man in the Bay Area during the free love era, mostly because they were all really, really high. Surprisingly, she's lived to tell her story in her memoir, My Life, a 4-letter word, Confessions of a Counterculture Diva.
Listen as Dolores talks about her friendships and run-ins with Divine, John Waters' colorful cast of characters, and watching friends of hers, like disco superstar Sylvester, die from AIDS. I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Fillion.
And this is Feast of Fun.
Feast of Fun is made possible because of financial support of people like you. Thank you. Upgrade your account today at feastoffun.com/plus and listen to our fabulous podcast 5 days a week.
Our guest today is Dolores DeLuce, one of the few women who got to perform with the Cockettes, a highly influential theater group of hippie drag queens from San Francisco of the early 70s. A 5-foot diva in 6-inch heels, Dolores has probably slept with every gay man in the Bay Area at that time, probably because they were all really, really high.
You got that right.
Surprisingly, she's lived to tell her story in her memoir, My Life, a 4-letter word, Confessions of a Counterculture Diva. Welcome to Feast of Fun, Dolores.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm having fun already. I mean, just being here in your apartment.
So you claim to be Divine's illegitimate daughter.
That's right. I really am.
Now, for people who don't know Divine, she was the drag queen star of many of John Waters' best films, we think, and became a notorious sensation when she ate dog poop on camera in his film Pink Flamingos. Yeah. Now, I have this dog poop that I scooped off fresh off the sidewalk this morning.
I told you I already had breakfast. And I'm on a diet. So
no otherwise dog I poop. Would,
yeah. Mama had her habits, but.
So you were friends with Divine when this whole thing happened?
Well, after he ate the dog poop, yes. Yeah. After Pink Flamingos, I met Divine in 1972 when I went to San Francisco with a friend who was a photographer and used to shoot the Cockettes and all. His name was Gil Robinson. He's now a Buddhist monk and lives in India. But Gil at the time was a long-haired hippie freak like all of us, you know, bisexual.
Gil Amelio.
Gil Robinson, okay. Yeah. He was a boy from Atlanta, actually grew up with Lyndon Sadler, one of the Cockettes, who I'm staying with here in Southside Chicago for my little tour right now. Uh-huh. So anyway, Gil brought me up there, and I saw my first ever Cockette show at the Palace Theater in North Beach with most of the original Cockettes and Divine guest starring in a show called Vice Palace. And I was blown out of the water. I mean, it was the most brilliant thing I had ever seen on stage, and then went backstage afterwards and met Divine, and there was like this instant bonding and chemistry between us. Divine opened her arms. She still had on her drag with the fake tits filled with little pellets that was
bird seed, right?
Something like that. It was some kind of pellets that made her bra. And she just like wrapped me in her arms. And it was just like an instant love affair. And then the next day I got to go to a party and he was there and we dished the whole night. I mean, it was so fabulous. a week later, 2 weeks later after their show closed, I was back in Venice Beach. I had a two-year-old daughter at the time. I was living with two gay boys in Venice. One was a drug dealer and one was a waiter, and me and my baby. And the next thing I know, I get a phone call, and it's Divine. Hi, hon. You know, she says, we're thinking about coming down to Venice. You think I could stay with you? I said, oh, of course. I mean, are you kidding? I was like, oh, my God. Divine wants to come and stay in my house. So I cleared it with my roommates, and, you know, they were a little, one of them was a little squeamish about her coming into the house.
A drag queen.
No, but he was like the straightest gay boy I ever knew. He was very.
But was Divine seen at the time as the world's most famous drag queen?
Not yet.
Was he in the situation that RuPaul is
in? No, not yet. This was the very early, early days. I mean, Pink Flamingos was the first one to get that kind of notoriety of John's films. They had done several other ones before that. But, yeah, but in the underground, yeah, we all knew who Divine was, but not the mainstream, no way near yet, anywhere near that time of his life. So he came down and stayed with us. And at that point in time, we formed a relationship that was almost like mother and daughter. I mean, we loved to cook together. You know, I'd make all the entrees and he'd do all the baking and the desserts. And I have a couple of chapters in the book about various adventures we had together during that. Actually, he came with not only his boyfriend, David Baker Jr., who was his matinee idol, who had done Tom Ines Theater in New York back in the day. Gorgeous, gorgeous guy. And he was in love with David, and I fell in love with David at the same time. So they were both there. And then David brought his friend, another actor, Lorenzo, and Lorenzo brought his dog, little brother. So they all came. They were a complete entourage, and they moved into my bedroom.
You know, all of these people?
All three of them and the dog, and Viva and I, my two-year-old and I, parked out in the living room because that was the only other bedroom in the house. They came for the weekend and they never left. I mean, they left eventually, but they stayed more than a month while Divine decided to find an apartment and live in Venice because he wanted to get out of San Francisco because it was cold there. Mm. So it was party central at my little Venice house.
Now, Venice at that period in the 70s, it was kind of out there, wasn't it?
Pretty wild. Yeah, it was mostly a gay and hippie drug addict mecca.
Well, hold on a second.
Anymore,
before
right?
you go talking about Venice, did you ever ask Divine, like, you know, why did you eat the dog poop? Did it make any sense at the time?
Of course. We all asked. Everybody always wanted to know that and asked Divine a million times. He always told the story about how freaked out he was. At first, he did it because John wanted him to do it. And, you know, they got ready to, and then they talk about this.
Was John on drugs? I mean, it's
no,
like,
John was just,
I asked him this question myself, and I'm still not satisfied with the answer he gave.
Well, they did do lots of drugs back
then.
Yeah,
of course. And there's a great answer. I mean, I've on film, the new Jeffrey Schwartz movie, I Am Divine, has this question answered. And I think he's either John's answering it or Divine is answering it in an interview that he had done when he was still alive. But, you know, on my story, Divine said basically what happened was, you know, John, he did whatever John wanted. You know, he was a trooper. Mm-hmm. And he said, but after he did it, he says, I freaked out so bad that I thought I would get like a disease from eating it that I went and called the hospital, the emergency room, and told them, pretended to be a woman on the phone. Says, I said, oh, my little son Johnny just ate some dog dew. What's going to happen? What should I do to protect him? So this is like what he did to try to make sure he, you know, wasn't going to get like vital, you know, totally ill from it. Mm-hmm. But it did freak him out after he did it, you know.
He never got sick from it.
No, he didn't get sick from it.
And so the record, Divine can ate the dog poop, never got sick.
No, he
behind
never got
the
sick.
Scenes. Because John Waters would be like, oh, sure, he got, you know, because he's the director.
Right.
If Divine got sick, the responsibility, the blame would go on him.
Well, that's true. But he did not. And he survived that and every other movie that John put him through hell to make. You know, and when you see Jeffrey's documentary, haven't you seen it yet?
No, we haven't seen it yet. I don't think it's premiered here
hasn't
in Chicago
been here yet.
Yet.
It should be coming shortly because it's going everywhere around the world. Mm-hmm. I've seen it a couple times. It's brilliant. And you'll see there's like a lot that Divine went through to maintain his career over the years. And so I went to actually when he was in L.A., they had in that time period, he went back after and shot Female Trouble and then came back or something. I don't remember the time. It gets all mushed up in my head.
Sure.
But we ended up going to the premiere in L.A. of Female Trouble. And someone asked me this question. I think Frank DeCaro asked me this question about, did you ever know there was another Dolores Deluxe? And that was there was another Dolores Deluxe.
Dolores Deluxe was your stage name.
Was my stage name in the counterculture underground. That's okay. The name I performed under. So I was in the theater with Divine for the premiere. I was his date. We shopped for Cha-Cha heels together. I got mine at Frederick's Hollywood to match it and wore them to the premiere. And the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence came. And all, I mean, it was like a big scene in L.A. It was at the New Art Theater or something like that. And at the end, the credits rolled. And the art director of this movie, her name was Dolores Deluxe. And I looked at Divine. I said, why didn't you ever tell me there was another Dolores Deluxe? You know, shocked. He says, oh, hon, I don't want to break your heart.
You know? So then people like, did you get any free stuff? Or they like, did you get any like?
People used to get us confused for years after
really?
That. Yeah. I would meet people and they go, oh, you're the one that works for John Waters. And no, I'm the West Coast actress. And,
you owe me money, lady.
Right. And she would be taken from me, you know. And one day we met accidentally at an airport on our way, you know, taking a midnight flyer from San Francisco to L.A.
And what'd you say to her? It's like,
well,
give me
I
her
don't
name
even
back.
Know how, no, how we got to know. I even figured out what her name was. She was carrying this gorgeous bag that she had made out of vintage drapery, kind of, you know, 40s yeah. drapery. Mm-hmm. And I said, where'd you get the bag? She says, oh, I make them. It's my line. I produce these. I said, oh, really? I can get it. She, oh, yeah, it's just they're called Dolores Deluxe something. I said, Dolores Deluxe? I said, that's my name. She goes, oh, that's my name, too. I said, no, you're not the one from Baltimore. She goes, yeah. Like, and we couldn't believe it. It was just so.
Did you guys stay in touch? Are you friends
no,
now?
No, not really. No.
Did you ever buy the bag? No.
No, I never got it. But, you know, like, it was just one of those situations, you know, where it was fun to meet her in the moment.
Then you had a friend, like, stab her tires and break her window.
No, she lived somewhere in Baltimore. No, I never cared. I mean, it was fine. Actually, it gave me more credits. You know,
absolutely,
people thought
yeah.
I was also an art director.
Venice Beach in the 1970s was when, was it Muscle Beach was first starting, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's kind of the golden era of California bodybuilding.
Oh.
So you must have seen
yeah.
lots of bodybuilders.
Honey,
there.
Arnold Schwarzenegger was one of my neighbors back in the day, back in the latter part of the mm-hmm. 70s, more than the early 70s. Mm-hmm. I don't remember him being there that early. Like, because there was that 4 years in between when I lived in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. I left Venice in 73 to do my first show, which Divine was responsible for, because he sort of mentored me and suggested that the people that were doing the show with the Coquettes were coming out of L.A., and they had Goldie Glitters was one of the original Coquettes who had moved to Venice as well. Mm-hmm. And she decided she had to have a comeback that fall in San Francisco. And they decided to do an all-drag version of Cinderella with her playing the lead. So Divine suggested they put me in the show. And the director was a choreographer from UCLA, Gary Bates. He ran the dance department there. And they were rather straightish type queens, you know. Mm-hmm. So they took on the challenge of directing the Coquettes. They had no idea what they were getting into.
Because they're kind of unmanageable in many
ways. Unmanageable. They didn't believe in rehearsals and all
and
that.
They did
kind
a
of
lot
stuff.
Of drugs.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Because you were high as a kite for many of the performances.
Oh, yeah. Well, the opening chapter of my book describes the whole night of that first show when I was high on my ass on acid.
As a pumpkin.
As a pumpkin, dressed as a pumpkin, dancing a modern ballet to Tchaikovsky. But Divine was responsible for that because we were just hanging out on the beach and they were planning the show. And I said, well, you need to put Dolores in the show. I mean, she's really funny. And, you know, I had never, I mean, the only show I'd ever done was my high school senior play. Mm-hmm.
You were a dancer, though, before a stripper.
Well, I was a go-go, nude go-go dancer. Yes, a nice
That's
way.
That's performative.
What's the difference between a nude go-go dancer and
a stripper?
A
stripper starts out with elaborate costuming
okay.
and takes
yeah.
it off, you know, like the old days yeah. of burlesque. Whereas by the 60s, we were just, you know, we started out with like G-strings yeah. and pasties. And then a few years into it, the pasties came off and it was just no nude, everything came off. It was stark naked. The only thing you got to wear were your high heels and your earrings, you know, and that was it.
So is that, why did the Coquettes kind of disband after? Was it because it was so helter-skelter and wild there?
Yeah, it had its day, you know. It was actually officially over before I ever even performed with them. Mm. Technically, they kind of dispersed after the New York fiasco. Right. This is a little lecture that Lyndon gave last night at the center about what happened. Because, you know, they were so unruly, and there was mixed factions. There were those people that were more professionally oriented who wanted to do really good work and rehearse. And there were some brilliant talent behind the writing and the music. Like Scrumby Colwin did all the music for most of the shows. And Martin Warman, who wrote all the lyrics to all my shows, who's passed now, he came out of, you know, like a fellowship theatrical, I forget the name of it. I talk about it in my book. But, and you know, there were some really brilliant minds that were creating this work. And then there were like the free spirits like Hibiscus and all these people who didn't really want to rehearse. They just wanted to go up on stage and show their asshole to somebody. And,
really? So Hibiscus was the one, because Hibiscus is credited with founding the Cockettes.
Well, he was considered the original founder. Yeah.
But, and you know, so his sensibility was to have a sort of like beautiful chaos unfold
exactly,
in front of an audience.
Yes.
Whereas a lot of the people were, he probably convinced the very theatrically trained people to get involved, you know, luring them with the idea
he didn't
that
have
something.
To lure
and it was
them.
Very
it was,
attractive, too.
Yes,
wasn't
he was.
It?
I mean, Lyndon talked about this very eloquently last night, and he said how there were certain people, like you just met them and you locked eyes and you just knew they were meant to be a part of your community, your world. Yeah. And that was, it was a magical time, and it really was. And Hibiscus was very charismatic, and he drew lots of people to him, you know. But at the same time, he was being very heavily influenced by a very leftist anarchist commune called Cauliflower, led by Irving, this guy Irving, who I never really met, but I heard was a horror nightmare. And he really controlled a lot of people with his political ideas. And and Hibiscus was very influenced by Irving. So there was, they had adamant rules about, like, you know, no money exchanged for, you know, they wanted to live in a free society where everybody bartered for everything. And so when the Cockettes, the faction that were more drawn to being successful in the real world, were involved, they became a schism. And at that point, there was a faction that broke off, and that they called themselves the Angels of Light. And they went with Hibiscus and Ralph and a few of the other Cockettes, forming the Angels. And so for years, there was these two groups in San Francisco that had the same roots, but one was doing totally free theater, and the other Cockettes were trying to, like, Sylvester came out of the Cockettes.
Okay.
Mainstream, you know. So Pam Tent's book tells the story of the history of that whole time very, very well. Have you ever seen her book?
No.
But today's show is about your book.
I know, but I'm just saying, it's true. But I mean, my book's really not about the Cockettes. Mm-hmm. It just happened to be...
It was a part of your life.
The part of my life that kind of introduced me to the theater. And like I say, I was in at the tail end of it.
And with the Cockettes, it's not just a theater group. It's kind of like, it's a way of life.
Movement.
And a cult in a kind of way, you know?
And I think what people don't realize, especially younger gay people today, they really started the trends that we see today and made them like available to mainstream society, like, you know, the outrageous lavish costuming that they did. You know, this today we take it for granted, but they were sort of originators. But they almost flash back to like Paris in the 30s too, like their influences came from that. You know,
well, certainly all their thrift store finds were from the 30s and 40s.
Exactly.
But if you look at pictures of, like, from the Cockettes, you see that influence still is alive today.
Yeah.
And you're like, this could have been a drag queen that was taken, you know, yesterday.
It
that
could
kind
have
of
been,
photo.
But they were,
whereas before that, from the 50s or 60s, it just doesn't have that same kind of look.
No, not at all. Means. They were more like the mainstream Finocchios.
And back then, it would have been a very challenging image for a lot of people to deal with.
Well, especially the Cockettes, too, because they...
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
A lot of them never bothered to do... They weren't trying to dress like women necessarily. Mm-hmm. You know, they didn't wear fake boobs. Some of them kept their beards long, you know, and still wore a dress. You know, it was just that kind of gender fuck, I guess they were going for.
In your book, you claim to have sex with pretty much everybody.
Not really. Wow. I left a lot of people out.
You name the number as 153 as the number of men you slept with.
No.
Why so few?
That?
Why so few?
Those
weren't you any good at it?
Those were not all San Francisco boys. That was just an inventory I took. At a certain point in time, I was trying to become a more sober, you know, human being, and I did an inventory, and I had to, part of that inventory was to do a sex inventory. So I sat down one night with a pen and paper and tried to remember every incident of sexuality that I had ever had as far back as I could remember. That was not all San Francisco. Okay. I didn't, that was like a lot of things.
That was Jersey, because you're a Jersey girl originally.
Jersey, it was LA, it was like tricks I had turned for money, you know, when I was stripping and go-go dancing. And, you know, there was a, but I did sleep with a very large share of the beautiful boys that existed in San Francisco. So much so that I left a lot of people out because I did not want to seem like I was bragging.
But you slept with a lot of gay men.
I know, but you see, well,
how did
you
that
guys,
come about?
Because you're so young, you don't realize how different it was.
Don't get any ideas here.
Well, I don't know. Somebody dropped their age a little while ago before we were on the air. But, you know, one of you is the age of my daughter, three years older than she is. But back in the 70s, you know, the lines weren't as clearly defined as they are now. You know, people had to finally at a certain point choose sides, you know, it got political in a way. But back then, I think the we were a blend of like hippie, free love, gay, whatever. You know, I mean, I've never really clearly defined myself. People ask me, what are you? You know, I always say, oh, I'm the B in LGBT. And you can take that however you want, bitch or bi or, you know, I mean, you know, double B, really.
I like that.
Yeah. So,
but so you had, you're saying that that our concepts of sexual identity were much more fluid back then.
They were more fluid
than they are today.
And the drugs were different. You know,
what drugs were you on?
Oh, well, I remember having three ways with my gay husband. After taking acid and Quaaludes.
Whoa.
And allowing him to do a certain thing to me that most men only do in really dark bathhouses. I won't say what.
Now you got me curious.
I don't know how much I can say.
You can say anything you want.
It involves hands.
Oh, fisting.
Oh, well, that's no big deal for a girl.
It's a big deal, especially one that's never been a big fan of anal anything. I'm sorry. But when you take that kind of drug combination, you become very loose.
So Quaaludes and acid makes it real loose. Okay.
Yeah, and
so
psychedelics.
Considering all the sex, drugs, and rock and roll you've done, you should be dead.
I should be dead, and I'm very fortunate that I did not get HIV, you know, because at least 25 of the names in the memoriam section of my book, toward the end of the book, I was lovers with all those men, and they're all dead today. But I think what happened was when I stopped my cavortin, you know, it was around 1980. I had a really profound spiritual experience with a meditation practice. And it was almost like I was struck celibate. And I had been gradually moving away from a lot of my wild behaviors because keep in mind, I'm raising a daughter.
Sure.
So I was in such a wild scene. I still was more conservative than most of the people that were around me in that time because I had to maintain a certain degree. I mean, I didn't do wild drugs and all this while my daughter was with me. Usually it was on nights when I had a sitter or something because I didn't want to expose her to a lot of the insanity. You know, of course, she was exposed to a lot, but the point was...
Well, she lived with Devine.
Yeah, I know, but we weren't, like, acting out in front of everybody. You know, I mean, we had some discretion, you know. I mean, and I was a careful mother in that way. I mean, I thought I was. I mean, there were times that it wasn't always perfect, but yeah.
So, but your daughter's turned out well-adjusted.
Right, exactly. But I gradually pulled away from drug use. Mm-hmm. You know, by the time she was two and three, I was, you know,
you were
tapering
done with it.
Gradually. I was okay. Totally done with it by the time she was six, seven, 8 years old with most of the drugs. You know, I didn't take the hard mm-hmm. drugs anymore, any of that stuff. I still smoked a little pot here and there. But then, so I was moving towards sobriety and being more conscious. And by 1980, I had this very profound spiritual experience that I wasn't necessarily even looking for. You know, it just sort of happened through whatever. And at that time, I was struck celibate. Like, there was this energy that came into me that was, like, fulfilling me, like, feeling like I was being loved from within, you know, mm-hmm. call it God, mm-hmm. call it whatever, higher power, whatever you want, that I didn't feel like I needed to have so much external validation. So it kept me away from having a lot more sex like than I used to in the earlier days. And I think that's when the AIDS virus started to really, you know, get a hold. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Because so many of my close friends were still out there doing what they did and mm-hmm. the anonymous sex here and there and everywhere. And at that point, I wasn't sleeping with most of them anymore, you know. So I was still a little on the edge because of a couple of lovers I had mm-hmm. that later, you know.
Were you shocked or surprised that people all of a sudden started dying at such young ages?
Well, that's a good question because I talk about this in the book. I had some prophetic dreams. I don't know if you got to that part in the book, but I had a dream back in 1976, I guess, six or seven, when I was getting ready to leave San Francisco and move back to Los Angeles because I was, you know, fed up with my professional career not going in the direction I wanted to go in yeah. San Francisco. So I decided to move back to L.A. And in that dream, I had it was almost like a prophecy. I was on a disco floor and I was dancing with all these men around me and, you know, this fabulous disco with a big giant skylight. And in the dream, I looked up into the heavens and there was a meteor, like a light hurling toward Earth. And it was just coming like at this high speed and it crashed through the skylight. And I'm trying to warn all the boys around me, going, look, look what's coming. Look what's coming. And nobody would, like, everybody was ignoring me. They were just dancing and doing their poppers and having a gay old time. And nobody saw me yelling and screaming. And all of a sudden, this thing crashed through the ceiling, and they kept dancing. And I'm looking at this vibrant golden thing, like pulsating on the middle of the dance floor, and they're just dancing all around it, totally not seeing it. And then all of a sudden, I gave up, you know, trying to warn them, so I just kept dancing. And then one by one, all these men started to become transparent. And then they went away. They just they were gone, all of them. And I was standing on the dance floor alone with this pulsating light, like in the shape of an egg. And I was all alone, and I was like sobbing. And then I went and I touched this thing that was in the thing, and it broke open. It was like a shell, like a big shell, and inside of it was like this golden Buddha statue. It was so bizarre, and I just. So there, and the
this
dream,
sounds like a Lady Gaga video.
Really, but it was such a profound dream that I wrote it down because mm-hmm. it was like it was it left
something
me,
is coming.
It left me with something, you mm-hmm. know, and it was like a warning. Here, I was trying to warn the men, you know, like, and nobody would pay attention to me.
And how did you interpret the dream at the time?
Well, I didn't know. See, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. So when you say, were you surprised? In hindsight, when this AIDS crisis started to happen, I had already received this meditation practice that was like a spiritual guide for me mm-hmm. that kept me kind of protected. And that's when my friends were dying. And I sort of put it all together like that dream was because I had other dreams that were prophecy, too, in my life. That was just one because I think I have a little bit of a psychic in me that I don't really pay attention to that much. But I do have moments when I see things and then they come to pass. So was I surprised? No, not really, but because I guess on some level I knew something, you know.
But I imagine besides it being devastating, it was like all of a sudden that could have been me, you know.
Well, but more than that could have been me, it was just like I had no idea what profound grief. Like, see, the thing about this community, my family, the book story is about family, really. It's about mm-hmm. the family that disowned me for having a biracial daughter out of wedlock because they're Italian Catholic immigrants that didn't understand or get me. So I was thrown out, abandoned by this family. And this entire queer family embraced me, gave me a sense of love and connection, and mirrored back to me who I really was, the beautiful swan, not the ugly mm-hmm. duckling, you know, that kind of thing. And
well, when your daughter Viva was born, your family disowned you.
Yeah, exactly.
And they disowned you because she was biracial.
Yeah.
And out of wedlock.
And out of wedlock,
even
too.
In the 70s, yeah. That's still yeah. a very...
Either one would have probably been enough.
Right.
It was enough that I even moved to California before I got married. I mean, that was a sin in itself.
Well,
so,
were you in some senses, because my mother is very similar to you in personality, and in the sense that she felt very limited by her family's conservative...
That's exactly how I felt.
...worldview, yeah. and so yeah. she just literally wanted to physically separate her mm-hmm. and have those brown right. babies, and, you
well,
know.
Well, I mean, I didn't go after any of this stuff consciously. It was all just a reaction of being who I was, and I... My rebellion wasn't on purpose. It just was like the only way I could be me mm-hmm. was to pull away from them. And I think I did so at a very young age because I really isolated from my family. The book talks about this in the mm-hmm. early part of the book in the Jersey years, how I never identified with that family. I always felt like I was dropped there on from an alien planet like Superman, and that my world was in the television. I learned everything I learned from watching old movies and musicals, TV shows, and Million Dollar Movie. And
you were starstruck.
Yeah, exactly. And so, but that life didn't match the life of a hard working class father who was in the produce business, who went to the market at 5 a.m. and worked till he was dead tired. My mother, who worked in factories. It was a very drab, gray life in New Jersey, in my sure. my point of view. And I wanted fantasy, you know. And so it came to pass that, you know, I got it.
You sure did.
In abundance. Yeah,
in abundance is right. It's really true.
Tell me what it was like to... So your daughter's fabulous now. She's world-famous jazz singer.
Viva, yeah.
How did you raise such a well-adjusted person?
Well, everybody asks me that question.
Considering the wild world you live in.
I think it skips a generation. I mean, that's...
that's not fair. And you're a very well-adjusted person yourself, aren't you?
I don't know.
how would you say
when I'm lying on the couch and can't get up, you know, for hours?
Everybody goes. Viva goes through those days.
We all do. My daughter's very productive. She works really hard. She's a much harder worker than I am. I was always lazy, you know. I always wanted the easy way out. I have to be honest.
Well, sometimes it's the smart way to work.
Sometimes it is, you know. And I see where it served me, and I also see in hindsight where it hurt me. You know, I could stand to have a little more discipline in my life. And, you know, I mean, I think it would make things simpler. I mean, I'm still... have no retirement. I own nothing. I mean, really, but I live on a lot of faith, obviously, and that's how I get by, you know. But,
well, you're a knitter to the stars,
yeah,
and you make good coin
yeah.
knitting things to, like,
right.
big A-list
I've
celebrities.
I've done a lot of creative things that have kept the rent, you know, paid, the roof over my head, my daughter fed, you know, but there was always that extreme, you know, all or nothing kind of highs and lows of being the kind of personality that I am, you know, one minute you're up and then like what Heidi Klum says, one minute you're in and the next minute you're out, you know. But my daughter, getting back to answering sure. that mm-hmm. question, I think that Viva, you know, like in any world that a child grows up in, I guess, I mean, she got the best and the worst. I mean, she had a family around her that loved her. I mean, she was adored by all her drag queen aunties and uncles, and they taught her to dance and to play and costume. You know, so she had a great childhood on a certain level. But then on the other level, there was all of these adult, so-called adult personalities who we were all children ourselves. And I refer to this in the book as like I was a child pretending, like that Joni Mitchell lyric from Blue. Do you know that album?
I know, I'm not
child
familiar with it.
Like a child pretending. It's about a child mm-hmm. that she gave up for adoption and she had. And raising my daughter was like that. I was still a kid in a way, didn't have enough sense to know that my daughter needed certain concerns. And, you know, so she got some bad shit that she has to go to therapy for still today and all of that. But The beauty side is that there was a lot of love surrounding her, and she did have a lot of positive influences.
Now, your daughter read the book. Was there anything
she's
in the book?
Reading that, right, she's reading it right now. She hasn't finished it yet.
Is there anything that's like she's surprised? Like, oh, Mom, I didn't know that.
She said to me, she's only about halfway through it. She's in Singapore right now. Mm-hmm. She left for Singapore for a four-month contract to sing at a five-star hotel the same day I launched my book in San Francisco for the first reading.
Wow.
And it was sad because she wanted to be with me for that. And I, you know, it was sad that I wasn't there with her because I miss her when she goes away, you know, because we're really close. And I've traveled all over Asia to be with her, you know, many times over for different, because she's been away a lot for the last 10 years on and off, on and off. But so she hasn't gone all the way through it, but she said she was really happy to be reading it just because there's a lot in here that I did not know. You know, that I did not know about you. You know, because you think when you know somebody, and a lot of my friends say this too, that have known me 20, 30 years even the ones that knew me even back then, they're reading the book and they're going like, you know, I thought I knew everything. I thought I knew all your stories, but there's a lot more that I didn't know, you know.
Well, you call yourself the Imelda Marcos of the welfare elite because you have too many shoes.
Oh, yes.
But not enough money to pay for the shoes.
No, I pay for them.
You did? Okay.
Yeah. Well, first of all,
thrift store shoes.
The majority of the collection came from thrift stores, yeah. And they were donated by queens that are no longer with us. They left me in their wills.
Did you really get
yes,
a lot of drag?
I got a box of shoes from a very petite drag queen called Tippi, who was one of the gals on the scene in San Francisco who worked with the famous Doris Fish. I don't know if anybody... They came.
That name sounds familiar.
Doris did all those incredible greeting cards. She was an amazing makeup artist, and she would create these characters and did wonderful performance. I think he was originally from Australia. Mm. He was quite a light in San Francisco. He's no longer with us either. Mm. And Tippi was his sidekick, and Tippi passed shortly after Doris did.
Our audience probably knows Doris Fish from the film that he created and starred in, Vegas in Space. That's Doris Fish.
One of his, yeah.
That's his big claim to fame.
See, Doris came a little bit on the scene after I sort of went away, like when I moved back to L.A., but I did know him and I knew Tippi. So when Tippi passed away, I got these beautiful collection of rhinestone-covered pumps because he wore the same size 6 that I wore. And so I have a lot of free shoes, and I'm still buying them, though. I bought, just before I left, I bought like a 7-inch pair of... what's that? Steve Madden. And I wore them last night at my reading. And one of the girls in the audience said, "More power to you." I was clomping around.
7-inch?
Yeah. Michael, well, there's like about a 3-inch platform, and then the heel is like another maybe 6 inches, you know. I'm a size queen. I'm always trying to measure. But
forget
Michael,
about the 6 inches. Let's talk
but really,
about 7. But what is it the Mae West joke goes?
6'7". Forget about the 6 feet. Let's talk about the 7 inches.
That's a good one. Michael Kearns, the last time I did a show with Michael in L.A., I wore a big pair of high heels. Because now I'm old. You know, I'm an old hag now. And it's really painful to put those shoes on and walk around in them. But, you know, back in the day, I didn't think twice about it. But Michael said to me one night, we were after the show, we were going to get something to eat, and I had my big pumps on. He says, "Honey, you're walking those shoes like you're a guy in the wrong size."
Michael,
I was like clomping around. He was right.
He doesn't
like,
hold back, does he?
No.
Listeners might remember Michael Kearns. He's been on the show a couple of times. He's the guy who did the happy
hustler. Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered ChumbaCasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+ terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+ terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hustler, the cover model for that.
And right.
actually lived that life.
He did.
In a way. Even though it was a fictitious life, he kind of emulated it after the fact. And you work with Michael, you do Queer Voices, is it?
It's called Queerwise.
Queerwise.
We're a group of LGBT seniors that mm-hmm. write, and we write every week. Michael runs our little sessions of writing. He's our teacher. And then about 4-6 times a year, we end up doing performances around L.A. We did one at the Village, you know, in West Hollywood mm-hmm. recently. We're going to do something at the library, West Hollywood, on November 16th. You know,
so is it mostly stories about back in my day, or is
No, it's not at all. It's like Michael gives us interesting prompts every week to write about, and it's very current. It's like, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of us are like where we are today, and like the last show we did, it was called Body Text, and it was about what it's like to be in an aging body.
Mm.
And he did the topic 4 weeks in a row, but he gave us a different prompt every week. So there's a diversity of stories. Like the piece that I ended up writing for the body was a dialogue that I was having with my body. Like it was almost like an argument between Ralph and Alice Cramden of the Honeymooners, you know, that
yeah,
self-loathing and, you know, like, look what you're doing to me, you dumb, you know, like, it, you know, so, I mean, everybody's mm-hmm. piece was completely different, and it's the really great writers in the group.
Mm.
So I love working with them and performing with them. The oldest guy is 84. He was an ad man in the 60s. He was like Mad Men.
So he was like a gay Don Draper.
Yeah, exactly. He's so fabulous at 84 still. I mean, you know, everyone, there's a lot of lesbians in the group that are great poets. What if,
that must be David Letick.
No.
What's
his name is Joe.
Joe, okay.
Joe, what's his last name? I don't even know his last name. I'm so
David
bad
David was
at
an ad man
name.
We knew. He did the Jean 2 commercials from the 70s we interviewed him before.
No, Joe,
he's fabulous.
Yeah, he's fabulous, too.
Now, you went to your friends with Sylvester.
I was. I mean, I wasn't like a great friend, but we hung mm-hmm. together.
Tell me about Sylvester's funeral.
I should probably read it. That part of the book is so great. John McGuire was a friend I met in Mexico with his lover, Tim McKenna, who was Sylvester's manager.
Mm-hmm.
And this was before I moved to San Francisco. I met them. And when I moved to The Hate in 1973, I found out that John and Tim were my neighbors. And so from that point on, we were front row center at every one of Sylvester's shows at this disco in San Francisco called The City. It was a disco upstairs, huge dance floor, mm-hmm. and downstairs was a cabaret, club, dinner, whatever. It was a fabulous club. And we would go like every time Sylvester was playing there, and then we'd go back to Sylvester's house and hang out. And, you know, and so I got to know him a bit, and he was very sweet. And I love Sylvester. He was great. He would hold court in bed. He'd take off his wig and his drag and put on a comfortable kimono and sit in the bed and light a joint, and we'd all sit on the bed with him and dish and talk. And
well, his backup singers grew on to be the Pointer Sisters.
Well, that group, he's had several. My roommate, Jerry, was one of his backup singers, too. And I have a story in the book about how, well, I won't go into that. My parents came from New Jersey finally to bury the hatchet, and Jerry was living with me along with, you know, about 10 other drag queens. Jerry was this very vocal black queen. He had a lot to say, and it was pretty fun. But anyway, so when Sylvester was dying, John, who he and I had like a long relationship, he was a lover, a brother, you know, friend ever since the day I met him. So we're going back to 1988 now when Sylvester died. That same year Divine died, that same year I lost four other of my dearest friends. It was a pretty traumatic year. So John took me back to Oakland. He was a very successful interior designer in L.A. by then. He owned a ranch in Malibu. He had a different lover named Winston Wilde. And he took me to Sylvester's memorial. And it was held at the Oakland Love Center, with Sylvester's church, his family's church. And it was like the most magnificent gospel scene, you know, that you could imagine. The tons of fun were there, you know, the weather girls.
Yeah.
And Martha. Two tons of fun. Martha.
Martha Wash.
Was one of his eulogies.
Who sang, it's raining men.
Exactly.
Hallelujah.
And I think maybe Ruth Pointer was there. I can't remember now. There were a lot of celebs in the house, as well as hundreds of fans. And then they had an open casket. And a procession going up to the casket. So John took my hand. John's a short Italian like me, you know, grew up in Seattle. He's fabulous. And we walked procession. Oh, and Sylvester was singing on the... They played Mighty Reel while we were doing the procession, right? And we went up to the...
Oh, you
well, because he planned all this himself.
That's
right?
It. Yeah, that story's in the book. Did you read that chapter?
I did read the book also, too. Yeah, but I've seen some other
right,
other
but
things
he ended
too,
up
because our listeners might be familiar with some of these names, but they're not necessarily like tied together.
Right,
so
right.
Sylvester's known for the song Reel. Mighty Reel.
Yeah, he was a huge disco star for a long time. So we're walking down the aisle to his casket. John's holding my hand. We're listening to Mighty Reel. We get up to the casket. Now, Sylvester had planned his every move of this funeral himself. Mm-hmm. And he was wearing this gorgeous...
Because he knew he was out on the way.
He knew. Yeah, he was wearing a gorgeous red silk kimono with gold thread embroidery. And then his lips were exactly the same color of the red. And he had the gold eyeshadow, the color of the, you know, I mean, he just looks stunning.
Stunning in the coffin.
I mean, and John just like grabbed my hand. We were just like, oh my God, this is too real. You know, it was like so amazing. And, you know, it was, you know, the joy. It was like that bittersweet, you know, like of something that we've lost some of these amazing people. And the saddest thing was that I was going to funerals with men that would be dying like just shortly after. You know, I remember sitting in church at one of the funerals and John's spirit passed through my body. He had already passed. And my other friend that was sitting next to me said, "Who's going to be left to help arrange my funeral?" he said to me. You know, I said, "Well, honey, maybe I'll still be here, I hope," you know, and then he ended up going. And
so what was sad. It like to go to Divine's funeral in the same year?
I did not go to the Houston. No, because they had some big public things that I don't remember being invited to. I think they were probably back east. I don't think they did
in
anything.
Baltimore,
yeah. I don't think they did anything in L.A. or San Francisco. And if they did, I just didn't know about it. Didn't hear about it because it was when Divine died. That was the most shocking of all
because he was cast to be on Married with Children day before they shot
and just
his scenes.
Right,
he died in his sleep,
and just maybe a month or so before that, he was in town and he was at a party. We were going to meet at a party that a mutual friend of ours was giving, and I remember we had a phone conversation because Divine left the party early because he couldn't handle the pressure. Like there were too many people. Trying to, you know, at that point, he had gotten so famous that it was hard for him to be in public if he wasn't in the mood to, you know, just be everybody on him all the time. So he left early and he called me the next day because we missed each other at the party. And we had a long conversation about, oh, this one's gone and this one's gone and how sad that is. And oh, and what about so and so? We're worried about this one. And, you know. So in a million years, I just didn't imagine that Divine would go because he was so big and strong. And in my mind, you know, I knew he didn't have HIV, you know.
Yeah.
And then when he died, it was a shock. You know, it was very devastating. Yeah.
The legacy of Divine certainly like carries forward in a lot of drag queens today. Mm-hmm. And certainly like one of the legacies, I mean, one of the famous scenes was like, "Who wants to die for art?"
Oh, right.
Everybody
right,
goes,
right.
Me.
And
he starts shooting everybody.
Right.
But it was that sensibility. And I'm not sure of like Divine, you know, was this John Waters' creation of this chaotic, violent, outrageous, badass drag queen?
Yes.
Or was this more a collaboration with him, Van Smith, the makeup artist, and
Well, I think it was a combination.
Divine.
I think John definitely created Divine, in a sense. Yeah. Van also created the look. But they couldn't have done it without Divine, the person Divine, who was such a magnificent performer. He was so brilliant on stage and screen. I mean, he just had that sense of timing. And I mean, even in his real life, his everyday, he was even more fun than on stage because he just had that wit, you know. I mean,
but John Waters said that in his heart, Divine wanted to be more like Elizabeth Taylor.
That's true.
Than this monster killed people.
It's true. Divine really had the fantasy
film.
Of wanting to be a film star. And he didn't want to just play women only, too. He wanted to have a legitimate career. Mm. And Jeffrey's movie points that out a lot. A lot of people talk about that in the movie.
Well, certainly we really only see him as a male a couple of times, really. You know,
But he was going to be playing
and Hairspray.
But outside of John Waters' films, Divine starred in several roles as a man, as a gangster.
He did that gangster role, and everybody really gave him a lot of acclaim for that. And the role he was going to be playing in Married with Children was a male role. And
Uncle Otto.
Yeah, and he was really happy to be having that job. So the irony of him dying the night before he was due on the set for his first taping was so tragic, you know. I'm best friends today with a guy named Rob Sadusky, who was Divine's personal assistant and wardrobe stylist, who traveled with him all the later part of his life. They met when they did Lust in the Dust, because Rob was costumer on that film, and then Divine and he became friends, and Divine hired him to, and Rob was there, you know, he had to go and identify the body. And so it was, and then Rob and I met years later working for Madonna, and we always felt like Divine brought us together. He's like my best friend today, you know, like my brother, you know, it's so funny.
Were you friends with, or known, I know your Edith Matthews was close to you.
No, we were not friends. I knew her just very briefly through, she moved to Venice.
She plays Aunt Ida in the film Pink Flamingos. Oh,
She left Baltimore, huh?
What is she like? Babs, where's the Eggman?
She was Edie the Egg Lady.
That's right.
Edie the Egg Lady. She played Divine's mother in Pink Flamingos. She sat in the little baby crib, you know, and just with a corset and just kept asking for her eggs. Baby, my eggs, you know. So she was a real character from Baltimore.
And then in Female Trouble, she plays Aunt Ida, who's angry at her son.
Because he's not gay.
Yes. Oh, Gator, I wish you were not. Found yourself a nice beautician boyfriend.
Yeah, why do you have to be a head? Why can't you be a nice homosexual? But Edie was, I didn't know Edie well at all. But what happened, my brush with Edie's fame was that, and I found this out just recently, Edie had a friend who I know, who was from Baltimore, who I know now. I think he's... It's Brian. One of my queer wise buddies in the writing group knew Edie. And he told me recently that Edie moved to L.A. because she knew she had cancer and she didn't have long to live. But I didn't know that at the time. She opened a thrift store on Abbot Kinney in Venice. But I was a contestant for the Miss Alternative L.A. contest. I think it was 1982. And Edie was one of the celebrity judges, along with Weird Al Yankovic and Dr. Demento. And of course, I won the Alternative Queen of Los Angeles. And Edie, you know, all the judges gave me tens, you know. And when they asked Edie how she picked me as the finalist, and she says, "Oh, I liked her the best because she looked just like a baby Divine." So that was like my validation that Edie's, the mother of Divine and Pink Flamingos, gave me, you know, the seal of her approval, and I beat out all these drag queens that were so pissed.
You made them eat
and
it.
I won. So when you have Divine as your mama, you don't fuck with me.
Tab Hunter, Divine's co-star in Polyester, who later came out as gay.
Yes.
Are you friends still or touch? Or
no, I just met him at Jeffrey's screening last year of Vito Russo, because they were all at John Waters was being honored that night at the Outfest Festival, and Jeffrey's film Vito, that the gay activist, this is the same filmmaker that's done the new Divine movie last year, was honored at Outfest, and so Tab was there. And I did meet him.
He did it with Anthony Perkins from Psycho. They were like lovers.
For a short while. Then Anthony went straight.
Yeah, well, I think they're doing Tab's a movie now.
Oh, are they really?
I think I read
his book. We tried to get him on the show, but he didn't really want to. Yeah. He didn't want to do press about it.
I don't know if...
He hates the media because they outed him in the 50s. Yeah, so he really just hates... Yeah.
See, he was not... I just met him very briefly that night at the gala, you know, whatever. But no, I didn't know Tab. I didn't know... I wasn't around Divine when she was doing Lust in the Dust and all those things because, you know, once the early 70s was over, Divine's career just kept taking off, and we didn't see each other for long, long periods of time. We would just see each other every once in a blue moon, you know?
Mm. So. What do you think about the role of drugs and alcohol in counterculture and in youth culture? You know, some people say it's like the role of being a young person is to get fucked up and make all the mistakes, get it out of the way so then you can grow up and and live your life.
Well,
but you know, are those mistakes you needed to make, or were the drugs an important part of it?
Well, I think I was lucky that I survived it. Number one, you know, as a mature woman today with a child of my own, it horrifies me to think what these youngins are doing today and the kinds of drugs they're taking. And
well, you saw Breaking Bad.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, which I love that show. I'm addicted to it. But the point is, yeah. I don't condone drugs today. And at the same time, even though I did them, I don't regret doing them because it did open my, you know, my vision, my insights to certain things. But drugs also brought a lot of death and destruction to my world and my friends. And I watched so many people die that how could I, you know, condone them? I mean, it's really hard. And I worry for young people today when I see them, you know, really out there on different things. I mean, look at the deaths.
They're taking some pretty intense stuff.
And they're taking more intense stuff. I mean, my drugs were pretty innocent in a way. I smoked pot. I did a little psychedelics. Mm-hmm. But I always did everything. I was an addict, but I was always an addict that used moderation. It was like, I think there's...
It's called risk reduction these
yes,
days.
Harm exactly.
reduction. Harm reduction,
yeah,
that's it.
Exactly. Well,
drugs. Just right. don't do a lot of drugs.
Yeah.
I mean, one thing that you guys shared in common is that you were doing drugs to chill out, to bond together, to have fun. And sometimes I see people like Sharon Needles...
Oh, God, yeah.
You know, a close friend of mine who sometimes I think, you know, allegedly might be doing cocaine in order to get to a gig, not necessarily to have fun. Yeah. And, you know, I think Sharon has a pretty good handle on her body and her mind. And but at the same time, I do worry for people in a similar situation as her that are like Donatella Versace in that wonderful made for TV movie, which we're all going to be talking right. about for weeks on out, played by Gina Gershon, where she's literally snorting coke
24/7. Well, yeah, 24/7, that's really when I stopped
get to work.
Doing drugs was when cocaine came on the scene. It had a whole other energetic that the drugs that we shared in common in the 70s didn't have, you know, because suddenly it costs a lot of money to get high. And us hippies, you know, we didn't have money to buy cocaine. So it became this thing where only certain people had the cocaine. And if you were cool and hip, they'd invite you into the room to do a line or two, you know. And it was so exclusive.
Elitist.
Yes, I hated that.
It was also more of an upper, too, where it's just the other stuff
exactly.
like pot and stuff were downers.
Yeah, but I hated that. I was thinking, oh, that's so awful. Like, because that's not what we were about. We were about sharing everything. And so that's when I never liked cocaine for that reason. And I didn't do it very often.
How much did a hit of acid cost?
Oh, like a dollar. I used to sell it. I sold acid and Quaaludes. You know, I was on welfare and I got my checks, you know, twice a month, and my prescriptions for, I'd get a 60 Quaaludes twice a month from my Dr. Feelgood in the neighborhood. And then I would go to the beach and I would sell the Quaaludes for a dollar each. I'd kept a few for myself. Mm-hmm. And that was my supplement to my welfare check monthly. And then I started dealing acid.
And then they stopped making Quaaludes.
I know. And they were my favorite, I got to say. That was great.
Well, and I guess, you know, it's...
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Ch-ch-chumba. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Seems like countercultural movements and sensibility and music and fashion has kind of been co-opted. It's been turned into something that has the big red letter H of hipster, which is cynicism, irony, and just a general distaste for being a child of many worlds. Mm. You know, the hipsters came from the beatniks, from the hippies, from the gays, from the black drag queens. It was like all these from jazz, and it was all kind of married in style. And it was a term that was embraced in your day. And now it's seen as a detestable term. And I think it's like really like unfortunate, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
Because when I identify as a hipster, people go, "You're not a hipster." It's like saying you're a communist.
Right, right.
You know,
right,
it's
right,
even
right.
worse.
Yeah.
And it's like, and then even the term communist is, I mean, the term hipster has kind of been reinvented to mean an asshole.
Yeah, see, I guess I'm so out of it that I'm not even really that aware of that.
Well, do you still see?
I'm just an old lady who sits and knits on the couch and watches a lot of television now and occasionally writes a book.
Would you still get out there and perform at all? Are you still doing some?
A little bit. You know, I did a thing at Lincoln Center a couple years ago where I did a number that was written for one of my shows because we were honoring the collected works of Martin Warman, who was one of the original Cockettes, who wrote a lot of the lyrics with Scrumley Colin. So we did an evening. They took his work into the archives, so they invited me to perform, and I did a song and dance and tap number that almost killed me, but I did it. I have a tape of it. It's fabulous.
I saw a little
did
bit.
You
of,
see
it's
the
on
dance?
Your YouTube Kickstarter video.
No, that
at the very end.
No, that's from that little bit of tapping. That was no, that was from a commercial I did for Planters Peanuts. No, the performance.
Why are you tap dancing on a
bubble
piece
pack.
Of bubble wrap?
Because it was a Planters Peanuts campaign that I did a long time ago. It was like in the 90s. It's the late 80s, where they were doing a campaign called Everybody Loves a Nut. And the big Planters nut would come out, and they'd introduce these freaky acts.
Mm-hmm.
So I was the act with the old-time accordion player, was my husband, with the accordion. And he says, "This is our version of pop music." And he starts playing Take Me Out to the Ball Game. And I roll out this sheet of bubble pack, and then I jump on it, and I start tap dancing to the song. It was a fabulous commercial. Anyway, that's what you see on that little snippet of tape. But the actual song and dance that Martin wrote, you could look on my YouTube videos. It's called Tapping in a Varicose Vein. And that was the last performance I did live. But like I say, I do a lot of readings, live readings around town. But it's easier because I don't have to do all the drag and, you know. And
you have a reading coming up here in Chicago. You'll be at Women and Children's First Bookstore on Wednesday.
Yes, I'm really excited. 7 o'clock on Wednesday. Please, everybody in earshot that's in Chicago, come get a fabulous book and I'll sign it. Something sweet
and
to
after
you.
Chicago,
I think if you promise people to tap dance on bubble wrap, they'll show up.
All right, bring the bubble wrap, though. I don't have my tap shoes with me, but I can.
You just take some like
fake it,
soda pop tops and put them on the bottom of your shoes. I think that's how they used to do it, right?
I don't know.
And so after Chicago is New York.
After Chicago, well, I'm flying into New Jersey first. Mm-hmm. Then I'm driving up to Massachusetts. I've got two book events. One in Amherst, Mass, at Food for Thought. It's a really cool bookstore. Huge LGBT community up there as well. Lots of students. And then I'm doing also one on the 14th on Columbus Day at the Lenox Bookstore in the Berkshires. Fabulous Berkshires because I have friends there and I'm going to hang out there. Right. Then I drive back down to New Jersey where my sister lives and go back into Manhattan. And I'll be in New York for a week and I'm doing my last event at the Leslie Lohman Gay and Lesbian Museum of Art in Soho on Worcester Street on October 22nd. I think that's 6 o'clock? I'm pretty sure it's 6. So but if they go to my website, counterculturediva.com, I have an event page, and it lists all my readings and the dates and the times and everything.
Wonderful. So. And on a side note, Women and Children's First Bookstore, which you'll be at on Wednesday, is up
in
for
Chicago.
Sale.
It's for sale.
Yeah, they're going to sell it. They want to keep it as a bookstore. It's making money, so it's not the people are retiring. So they say that they'd stay on to help, like, you know, the transition or work part time, but they kind of want to retire from it.
I didn't know that.
Yeah,
that's sad.
I just found out about it today. I saw.
So if you want to own a countercultural bookstore in Chicago with a great history, now's your chance.
Really, I'm just so excited to find out, which you told me just before we started, that Hillary Clinton read there.
Yeah.
I mean, that's
really... Well, technically, she didn't read inside the store. She read at the Swedish Museum next door.
Oh, okay.
But it was the women and children's first event. But there were so many people there that they couldn't
had to bring
accommodate.
It to a bigger...
They've had some very some events talked there. Really? Who else? I mean, they've had some big names there.
Right.
For
okay.
Sure.
Well, Dolores DeLuce is going to be there, and so come on, let's make Hillary look like. No, I love Hillary, but I want y'all to come out. That'll be fun to meet.
What do you think is going to happen with the government shutdown? The topic on everybody's mind.
Well, now
that
I'm not on welfare anymore, I don't care. I just say, don't pay your taxes. Let it really shut down, and let's see what happens.
Well, so because that kind of like the Tea Partiers are feeling like, you know, they're wanting the government shut down. They want to basically throw the economy into the toilet. You know, and my concern is like people with HIV medications won't get their meds.
I know. It's horrible. I don't know what to say about this. I mean, there's the anarchist in me, you know,
will happen.
Yeah. Let's see. Really. You know, I mean, you talk about shutdown, but are they really? I mean, I hear they're starting to take back things now. They're going to allow this and they're going to allow that and they're going to allow seniors to still get this. So I think they're backing down. I haven't really been following it the last few
days. It seems terribly dysfunctional, though.
Well, honey, it's no new news. Yeah. the government has been dysfunctional for a very long time.
And now we're just starting to see more of it.
Well, yeah, it's pretty sad, I think. That's why I almost think that sometimes a system needs to have a total collapse before it could be rebuilt again. Mm-hmm. And it's gotten to be so corrupt and
horrible. And hopefully, too, like the people's eyes will be open to just what's happening and what the extent that these people are willing to go to get these things done. And you have a real reckoning that you need to take part in the political system.
Yeah, so. It's amazing to me. I mean, I'm just glad I have a spiritual perspective on life. When I look at the world, I just get scared. It's like, oh no.
What if the two most frightening words?
Yeah, exactly.
And so in a sense, like your spiritual perspective is just like, let's just watch it, see what happens.
No,
let's watch the world
at peace.
No, I am truly the Madame Lafarge of the new age. I just sit there and knit and watch television and let the heads roll. I don't know. I mean, I don't like to say that because I have a lot of friends that are very they're really strong activists and they do get out there and they really work hard and they fight. Yeah. But, you know, I mean, I think that's important. You know, I think people need to do that. But on the same token, I don't know how effective it really is in the long run. It's always like you're preaching to the choir. The people that have one point of view are going to maintain that. It's hard to see how real change comes about. I almost think it does have to come about in consciousness, that little by little people...
But I think preaching to the choir is a change in consciousness because it gives us the words to express ourselves with. Because we have these sentiments, but not necessarily the ability to say it.
I just think that we all do it in different ways. I think in my day, when I was on stage a lot, my politics came out through my performance, whereas other people felt like they had to take it to the streets and march and do all that. And I agree that I think everybody has a part to play. It's just figuring out where your part is and do the best you can. You know, I mean, I really don't know what to do about anything. In a sense, you know what I mean? I mean, to be totally honest, what do I do, you know?
Well, I think that's very honest and very warm. At the same time, it's like, I think you're a person that's full of love. And in some ways, it's touched the lives of all the people that you've come across. Some extraordinary people throughout the years in a really rich and meaningful way.
Well, I think that's all that any of us can do is like to affect and touch our immediate world, you know, the people that are close and then the circles around them. Because if all we do is like little acts of love and compassion and kindness to who is ever in our vicinity, that has to create a ripple effect, you know. And I think that's like where I'm talking about the spiritual perspective is like do the best you can every day to be a decent human being and live your life.
Is that what's matter with kids today, maybe? Is that acts of kindness are not seen as glamorous, and everybody wants to be glamorous. Everybody wants to be a celebrity.
Well, that's a very, I mean, there's that movie that just came out that Sofia Coppola did about that gang that was robbing the, like, Paris Hilton and the... You know, do you know the movie I'm talking about? The Bling Ring?
No.
Oh, you don't know about that? No. You know, it's about all these kids that are emulating, like, you know, all this affluence and wanting to just be famous for no reason at all. And, you know, and they were breaking into these homes in Hollywood, these, like, these kids, you know, high schoolers, mm-hmm. and stealing all their stuff because, you know, they go to Paris's when I don't know how they got through the security systems, but they did.
But there were like
they stole her dog, didn't they?
Yeah, they stole her dog. They stole everything. Yeah. You know,
wasn't there like a tribe of thieves that were robbing from Paris Hilton?
Yeah, that's what I'm talking
about. And Lindsay
Lohan. That's what I'm talking about.
Oh, this is the same people.
That's the same people. Okay. That's what the movie was based on, was that group. And so I'm saying there is that element in the youth culture that is so vacuous. I mean, you know, all they care about is stuff, you know. And but then you see other kids in the society who are not that, you know. I mean, there, you know, there was a kid recently on, I don't know, one of the shows, that I was The View or something. I don't, maybe it wasn't The View, but, you know, who had done something really honorable because he had a brother who has MS and can't participate. Mm-hmm. And whenever his brother would see kids playing, he would be so sad. And this kid took his brother in a wheelchair and did some amazing event with him. I can't remember. It was a marathon or whatever. So, you know, so there are kids in the world.
He's famous on YouTube and he's gorgeous. The brother
is
a hunk.
But that's what I'm saying. So there is people like that.
Part of the reason we're fascinated with him is because he's so good looking. And his brother with MS is so adorable.
Yeah.
And it's like, and you're just like, I want to have MS and be in his arms too.
Well, that's one way of looking at it. But the truth of the matter is there is goodness in the world. And I don't think that all the kids today are getting that same mess. Maybe the majority, are. But
well, so do we need to make acts of kindness and generosity glamorous somehow? And it's because this is one thing that these new political movements, like No Hate, for example, have been criticized, is that they're more about fame and celebrity and glamour than they are about bringing political change.
Hmm.
And I'm like, whatever motivates people to get them politically active is a good thing, even if it is superficial things.
Yeah, as long as they can actually do something, if they're getting people to move and make things happen. I mean, I don't know. Like I say, I don't really jump on to the political perspective behind things.
Sure.
But yeah, I mean, I think like whatever can be effective, use it if you have to. You know, people are going to criticize whatever, you know, they're going to criticize the best of anything, you know. So there'll always be the haters.
Haters going to hate.
And they're always going to be the lovers like me.
tell me, your book is on Amazon. It was in the top 20, and you were like all ecstatic, and you had to read the two negative reviews of your book.
No, I think it's important to read the negative reviews. I don't take it like oh my God, I've got a bad review. Because, you know, who said some famous person said, if you're going to read the positive reviews, you believe those. You have to believe the negative ones too. But I mean,
feel very schizophrenic.
Well,
like,
no.
I'm an awesome person and a terrible person.
I love getting the positive reviews. Of course, you love people saying how I get like notes and emails from cousins that I've never met that have read my book and how touched they are and didn't know, like, oh my God, he had this freaky aunt and we didn't know who she was and what she was doing. And now we read her book and it's like, wow, you know, so that's exciting to me, you know, just that you could affect one person by just being honest and mm-hmm. telling your story. I mean, that's pretty cool for me to have that experience right now. And then whoever these strangers are that are writing reviews, most of them have been very positive. But the couple that didn't, I almost had to laugh. Like I tell you, the one woman wrote, this book is stupid. I'm glad I got it for free. It's not even worth saving on my cloud. I'm deleting it right now. I just had to laugh at that because obviously then I went and checked to see other reviews that she's written. And they were all like these, you know, praising these fundamental Christian books, you know. So I thought, why did she even choose my book in the first place?
God told her to.
Well, because it wasn't in the top 20. Book. A lot of like Christian conservatives go to the things on top of the list.
Right.
For some reason, our podcast is out of their radar.
Oh, that's good.
Like, we get hate from LGBT people.
Well, I do too over the years I have, yeah. You know.
But the Christian conservatives, fundamentalists,
they leave us alone.
They leave us alone. We're too crazy or too wild for them or something.
Well, when I was in the height of my career, I was doing a show called Broken Dishes. Me and another woman, Amber Waves, wrote a two-woman musical. It was a big hit in San Francisco in the 70s. There was a group of queens, very political activist queens in the Castro. Teddy Mathis was one of them. I slept with two of his roommates.
Of course you did.
Why wouldn't you?
And these boys wore, you know, feminine clothes. They wore drag all the time and stuff like that. And Teddy, but he put out the word that my show was politically incorrect. As women, we were portraying negative images of women and how politically incorrect we were. And I thought, get over yourself, girl. First of all, you're a boy in a dress. Who are you to be telling me what a woman should be saying about her life? So this was a very serious political activist in San Francisco. You know,
I mean, who was a drag queen as well?
Yes, yes.
Wow.
This was in the 70s. Yeah, there was. So that's
glad
what I'm
that
saying.
Decade's over.
That's why I'm saying, honey. You know, there's always going to be somebody who's going to criticize you for something. So at this point in time, I don't give a damn. You know,
you just it's roll like, with it.
Yeah,
for sure.
Exactly. I'm too old to care.
Dolores De Luce, your book, fabulous Confessions of My Life?
My Life, a four-letter word, Confessions of a Counterculture Diva.
So the four-letter word is fuck. Your life is fucked.
Or love.
Or love.
Or lust.
Or life.
Or shit.
Or drag.
But when you say four-letter word, you mean fuck.
I mean life. My life.
Oh, life.
Is L-I-F-F-E. A four word. Yeah. Not my life. My life.
My life is a four-letter word.
It's whatever you want to make it.
And boy, that's a lesson we can all learn. We want to remind people that Feast of Fun is made possible because of your financial support. This one-of-a-kind in-depth programming would not be possible if it wasn't for you. Go to feastoffun.com/donate and make a contribution.
And the best way to support the show is to become an ongoing member, and you can do that at feastoffun.com/plus because your monthly donations or your yearly subscriptions make the show happen. Because without the show, you know, without your contributions, we just really couldn't do the show.
And also, when you upgrade your account to feastoffun.com/plus, you get the podcast the minute they're posted, not hours later. So the free show sometimes comes out, you know, because RSS feeds and iTunes don't update them immediately, instantly. They're not up to the moment. They're not fresh. But if you really enjoy having the podcast, the minute they come out, for you guys who drive to work in the morning, those of you guys who live overseas, who want to get the podcast right when they're posted, upgrade your account today and you get all the shows the minute they come up. So
Dolores, thank you for coming on Feast of Fun today.
Thank you. It's been really a great time. I'm so happy to meet you guys. Really. Seriously.
It's been a pleasure.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, Dolores. Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.